How is it that we find ourselves surrounded by such complexity, such elegance?
The genes of you and me,
the genes of you and me,
we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA. We're all made of DNA.
Hello and welcome to DNA Today. I'm your host, Kira Dineen. DNA Today informs you on what's happening in the genetic world. During my broadcast, I educate the publics on genetics, public health topics, through lots of things, event coverage, news stories, book movie reviews, interviews, anything that kind of sparks my interest. Guests include genetic counselors, researchers, patient advocates, and professors in the field of genetics, and I'm lucky enough to have an interview today. Today I'm joined by guest Nivana Christozova. She's in the field of research working with chaperones, which are stress-related proteins, and she's focused on plants in unfavorable environmental conditions. She maps molecular interactions of those proteins and client proteins. She's very interesting. She started her education in biotechnology in her home country of Bulgaria. That's right, she's not an American, which is so exciting. Then she moved to Helsinki for a master's degree in natural resources and is now in her last year as a PhD student in the Flemish Institute for Biotechnology in Brussels. She's been working on molecular mechanisms of plant resistance and protection against pathogens and environmental conditions. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
It's very exciting to talk to someone that is in another country. I think you're my first guest that's not from America, so we get an outside view of the world.
Yay!
No pressure, right?
Not at all.
Can you start by explaining what a chaperone is? Some people may have remembered it, you know, that the word is familiar to them from high school biology, but can you explain what a chaperone is and how it relates to plant growth?
Yeah, of course. So I would like to start with a little anecdote to explain it. My favorite story is where the word chaperone comes from. So back in the days in like 1700s, 1800s, a chaperone used to be an elderly woman that would introduce a young lady to the society when she was not supposed to roam around still alone. It wasn't decent. So that usually would be her mom or her aunt or whatever. So basically, from that point of view, chaperones are those proteins who help other proteins basically emerge into life when they're being synthesized. They help them fold and acquire this proper shape that makes them active and just lets them do their thing afterwards. There are chaperones in all organisms that we know of so far, and definitely more than one type. And if you think about it, if a chaperone is helping a newly synthesized protein to acquire its shape, it's definitely, absolutely necessary for the growth of an organism when you have a lot of proteins being made to allow this organism to grow and do its things, synthesize its molecules, use the resources from the environment and whatnot. So you need a lot of those chaperones to help everything, every new protein that is coming out to form well. So that's the most direct way that chaperones are involved in growth. And there's a very interesting type of chaperones as well, which are found in the nucleus of eukaryotic organisms, that they're special in a way that, you know, how the DNA is nicely tucked around the
histone proteins.
The histones, yes, thank you, keep it neat and organized. So every time you need to express a gene, for example, you need a chaperone that unwinds the DNA from this histone protein to make sure that it keeps it straight and allows enough space for the other transcription machinery to express this protein, or when you need to copy all the DNA so you would allow the cell to divide later on, chaperones help in that as well. So yeah, they're pretty much involved in every process that you can think of, directly or not so much.
And if you can't, you know, unwind the DNA to be able to produce proteins off that, because the DNA, if it's tightly wound, you can't really get at it, it's not accessible. So if you can't do that, pretty much life would just stop there.
Yeah, more or less, yes. It can happen without the help of chaperones, but it will take forever for those proteins and DNA to find the proper conditions and to acquire the energy to do it on their own without the help of the chaperones.
So it's kind of similar to the role of an enzyme, like speeding up processes. Like if we didn't have enzymes, certain enzymes, a process could happen, but it'd take a really long time. So it's kind of the speeding up mechanism.
Exactly. There was a very nice estimation when I was in high school. I really don't remember the exact number, but our biology teacher was telling us that without chaperones, a protein is perfectly fine to fold properly on its own with trying all the possible conformations it can acquire, but it will take like millions of years literally, and that's really not compatible with life, as you can imagine.
Not really. Someday no. Maybe we can live that long, but as of right now, probably not.
I'm not sure that I would be willing to live millions of years. Maybe a bit longer, but not millions.
that would be a bit of a jump, but you know, possibly in the future, you never know. So what kind of plants are you studying these chaperones in?
Well, we isolate our chaperone proteins from really different plants. So we study chaperones in model plants, for example, the very famous Arabidopsis thaliana, which is like the Drosophila of the plant world.
Building blocks, like the most simple plant to deal with. Okay.
Yes. So that are really the chaperones that are involved in the very basic processes like helping newly synthesized proteins to fold properly. On the other hand, we are trying to isolate chaperones from plants that we know, for example, are better suitable to survive certain conditions of the environment, that we know that it's not only other enzymes or their structure that allows them to do that, but there's a chaperone involved. So, for example, you have plants that grow in the desert in extreme heat and drought, and we know that at least part of their ability to survive those conditions is due to the presence of different type or bigger amount of proteins that they express in order to keep their molecules well formed. So another function of the chaperones is to protect already existing chaperones and components of the cells from misfolding or aggregating when the environment is not very welcoming for them, basically.
So do you isolate certain genes that end up producing those chaperones in those plants that, say, do really well in a dry environment or do really well without sunlight or something like that, and isolate genes that produce the chaperones to then possibly introduce in new plants to give them those kind of aspects and that little superpower, I suppose?
Well, it can go in very different directions. For example, if we know from a model plant that a particular type of chaperone is helping it survive better this or that condition, we can try and, by sequence similarity of the genes and the proteins, try to find similar proteins in other plants that we're more interested in keeping them surviving better. For example, crops or other types of useful plants for agriculture. And once we find them there, we can isolate them and try to see whether they have the same function or something. It might be that they have something completely different to do in that particular plant. Or it can go the other way around. For example, if we see that a type of plant that we find in the wilderness, for example, survives some condition much better, we can try and basically, by excluding our options, try and see which protein is the one that makes it survive better. Try to find the gene that codes for this protein. And for example, by putting this gene in plant that is not resistant to this type of stress, prove that indeed this protein is the one that made the new plant also resistant.
So how do you end up actually studying like this relationship between the proteins and the response of the plants? How do you do it like on a molecular level? Because you can be looking at the different plants and seeing their responses, but how are you introducing the new genes or kind of just looking at it in the lab?
Well, again, there are like thousands of methods that you can try. It really depends what knowledge you have, what methods you know and what you can use, what machines you have in your lab, what know-how the people around you have. And sometimes it depends on the type of the protein, because not all proteins are happy in all types of methods. So, for example, if you know that a protein, if you've seen already that a protein protects a plant against a type of stress, the first thing usually that you do is you try to see where is it localized in that plant. So you usually hook up like a fluorescent or a colorful tag to it, and you try to see where is it in the plant, in which type of tissue, and then later on you can try and see in which part of the cell it localizes. So then you would have better idea in what kind of proteins it might be interacting in there by observing it with a fluorescent microscope or some other type of microscopy. Another very useful thing that you can do is you can try to co-immunoprecipitate your chaperone with its client, which is sometimes very tricky because these chaperones don't necessarily bind very tight to their clients. They have sometimes very transient interactions. So the interactions between the two molecules is not always strong enough that you can co-purify them when you break the cell and try to isolate it. But if you succeed, you would have a one of the native clients of your chaperone, and you would know for sure that, okay, this chaperone is helping this protein, and if this protein, for example, is an enzyme that is vital for the plant, you would know that because of that, it's actually able to survive better a condition that normally it wouldn't if it didn't have that chaperone.
So it's really looking at, like, the relationship between chaperones, not only the relationship between a chaperone and the plant's response, but really relationships between chaperones and proteins.
Yes, yes. So most of the times when I talk about chaperones, I talk about protein chaperones. There are pharmacological chaperones, for example, that are usually small organic molecules that stabilize enzymes, for example, but that's something very different. So protein chaperones usually bind to other proteins. Sometimes they have been shown to be binding to membranes, for example, to stabilize the membrane when there's, for example, not enough of a water available and they can collapse and cause problems. But most of the times they do bind to other proteins, and you can study that even with crystallography or NMR or all sorts of molecular techniques that you can see really on an atomic level how the two proteins orientate to each other and what kind of movements do they do to keep them both happy.
So what kind of other proteins are there that are related to stress other than chaperones? Are there molecules that are very similar to it? And do humans kind of have any of these? That is it just in the plant world, or is it also in the animal kingdom?
Well, so chaperones is a very broad term for proteins. There are these so-called active chaperones that really use energy from the cell to actually do their business, either fold a protein or keep a protein folded. And there are these so-called passive chaperones that, for example, stand between unfolding proteins like a shield. They wrap around them and protect them from sticking together, because you can imagine if you have a globular protein that starts to unfold because whatever reason, probably the environment, there's not enough water or there's too much salt or the pH is not optimal, it will start unfolding and it will start exposing these hydrophobic regions, which really don't like to be exposed to the water in the cytoplasm, for example, and will start sticking together. So sometimes they form these inclusion bodies, which can be extremely toxic for the cell, and they're very hard to break down. So for one thing, you create something toxic, and on another hand, you can't really recycle the amino acids from those proteins, so you'd make new ones. So it's very costly to allow proteins to stick to each other. So you have these types of chaperones that really just wrap around unfolding proteins to just make sure that they don't stick together. So on later stage, when you don't have stress, for example, anymore, the cell is much more fit to recycle those and make new ones or refold them and try to use them again.
Because it's much more cost effective for the plant to be reusing rather than making brand new proteins.
Yeah, most of the times, yes. So from that point of view, there are more and more proteins that are being classified as chaperones that are slightly diverse from the original idea we had for chaperones. In plants, you have these huge class of proteins that are called dehydrins, and the ones that I actually work with. They're called dehydrins originally because they were found in states of the plant where there's not enough water. For example, the seed, as you can imagine, the seed is a very dry state of the plant, and it doesn't have a lot of metabolic activity, but it still needs to make sure that whatever proteins are there, they're still active for when it needs to sprout out and make a completely new plant. So many of the seeds accumulate these dehydrins simply to protect their vital enzymes, and those are proteins that often have been shown to bind a lot of water. So it's like a bit of a sponge to make sure that you have a secret water supply in the seed for the really early stages of the plant development. And lately, more and more of those dehydrins have been reclassified as chaperones because we start to find how they actually protect the enzymes in the seed. And some of them are expressed in the grown-up plant, for example, as well. Again, in conditions that would make the plant benefit from them being present in the cell. There are many ways that a chaperone can help an organism, and they have a lot of different functions that we're only beginning to really understand and get a grasp of all the variety that chaperones have. And yeah, humans definitely have chaperones, and a lot of them.
Are chaperones in humans related to any type of human conditions where maybe the chaperone doesn't work that well and results in a certain type of disease?
Well, unfortunately, yes, there are those cases when, like everything else, we have these useful things that if for some reason they're not working properly, they turn out to be rather harmful than actually helpful. For example, in inflammation, we've started, not me, but scientists have started realizing that during inflammation, there are a lot of chaperones being released in the extracellular environment. And there are a couple of hypotheses that so far receive quite a decent support from the data that we get from the labs. One reason might be that the cells are actively secreting chaperones in the extracellular environment to try and help the proteins that are supposed to be there and are in a bit uncomfortable condition, whatever it is. If you have fever, for example, you would have higher temperature, which is not good for your own proteins either. Or it can be, for example, if there's certain damage to the extent that it causes your own cells to lyse, they basically burst and release everything that it's inside, not just the chaperones. But you can detect higher amount of those chaperones that are supposed to be inside your cell outside of it, which is a good indication that there is an inflammation and there's something wrong going on in that area or in that organism. Recently, there have been talk about chaperones being involved in the development of conditions like Alzheimer's, where we have absolutely no idea, for example, whether at this stage, the chaperone can be a causative function. For example, if I have a mutation in my chaperones that are supposed to clear up aged or misfolded proteins from my extracellular brain compartments, and they're not doing their job, is it that the reason why these proteins start accumulating there and form these plaques that are known for Alzheimer's? Or is it because another reason makes so many of these proteins, tau and A beta, being accumulated in the brain that the chaperones just cannot keep up, even if they're active, clearing them out, and that's why they start forming these plaques. So it's a bit like the egg and the chicken question, that we don't know which one is the reason and which one is the result, and I actually don't think that it's a straightforward answer. It's probably a mixture of the two, among many other things.
There's a lot of research then that needs to be done in order to even understand these processes and their relationships with human disease before we get to any kind of treatment or cure. And that's kind of the theme in a lot of different fields of science that we just don't know. And that's, you know, kind of sad on one token that we don't know enough, but you know, on the flip side, it's very exciting because we get to really say, we don't know a lot of this, and we can find out and use different methods to find this out in different states of mind and really looking at approaching it from different fields.
Yeah, true. Well, yeah, depends on your point of view. You can just sit around and be depressed of how many things we still don't know and can't figure out with with the tools we have in hand, or you can just suck it up and go to the lab and try to figure it out.
And another thing that we don't know a lot about, and maybe the effects it has or that it doesn't really have a lot of effects, are GMOs. They've been, I'd say, you know, pretty in the news more recently than in the past. You have an interest in GMOs. Can you explain what they are and really what this controversy is, whether we should be eating GMOs or not?
Yeah, so GMOs are actually my soft or sore spot, depend how you look at it. So to begin with, GMOs are genetically modified organisms that have introduced one or more genes from a different species into their genome, which is functional when they develop as an organism. The thing that really bothers me about GMOs is actually the controversy about it. It's when you Google, for example, GMO, at least here, I don't know, I tried the other day, I have no idea how is it in the States, but here, when I Google GMO, the first thing that appears is this little description that literally says an organism which has its DNA artificially forced to alter by introducing DNA from another organism. And then you immediately give this negative connotation to the thing, that if I'm someone who just heard on the news about it and have no idea what a GMO is, you immediately are exposed to a negative idea about it without being presented a neutral set of information first, so then you can make up your mind about it. And I think that the biggest fault for that was originally of the scientists. Because in the early ages of the GMO, in the GMO technology, when scientists presented those organisms, there was a lot of, concern. Of course, if there's something so new and so different and coming out of a lab, of course you would be concerned whether if it's safe, whether it's good for you, whether it's actually as useful as the scientists say, which is normal. But what happened is that scientists kind of were a bit frustrated that people didn't embrace the idea as willingly as the scientists did. So they stepped back, they closed up in their labs and decided not to get part of it and let it settle down and then maybe start talking about it again, which just gave people with less knowledge on the technology the opportunity to start talking about it and practically demonizing it just because they were too afraid of it. And I think the problem is that still till this day, scientists are not talking enough to the public, because in most cases, our research is being funded by taxpayers' money, at least in Europe.
Same here, yes.
Yeah, so we kind of own it to those people. They pay my salary, they pay my consumables, they pay me the ability to go to the lab and do the things I do and try to deliver something back that it's useful. But if I don't explain to these people that most of the times wouldn't have any idea of biology or genetics or whatever, if I don't put the effort to explain them simply why is this useful for them and why do I believe it's safe, given that I've tested it so many times, of course they wouldn't accept it. So, yeah. And then people that are against GMOs get more and more publicity because they're much more vocal than scientists. And it's this really uncomfortable situation for me that people that know less get to say what happens with the technology, and that's just not right for me.
Definitely. There's in Europe, I wanted to ask you, is there a law that GMOs have to be labeled in grocery stores? Because I know there's a difference between America and Europe in terms of how much you have to identify GMOs.
Well, it's actually, that's one thing that I find extremely crappy about Europe, and I am a little bit envious about the US.
Yeah.
That in Europe, we are not even allowed to grow GMOs. Like,
really?
At all. Not at all. If you grow a GMO, and if the institutions that are working on the screening and the monitoring of crops, if they come to your field and test your crops and find that it's GMO, they're practically allowed to exterminate everything, and you lose literally every single plant that you had. While at the same time, there is certain limit of foods or certain percentage of our foods, of their content, that is allowed to be GMO. So basically what happens is that we don't allow our own farmers to grow GMOs, but we allow our food production companies to import GMOs from Brazil or from the US or from where not, and put them in their, in our food, which is totally mind-blowing for me. It's completely counterintuitive.
That's very different because here in the United States, I don't know that much about GMOs, but from what I understand, we do not have to identify if, you know, produce is GMO. And a lot of people are eating GMOs that don't realize there are. But, you know, from what I'm understanding personally, I don't think that is such a big deal. I think people that are against GMOs may not be as educated as you indicated before. So it's definitely a difference between countries and just legislation on how that affects, you know, humans eating GMOs and being aware if they are or not.
Yeah. Well, to be honest, I haven't seen here in the market, maybe because I don't look for it, but I haven't seen a product that says contains GMO. But I always see things labeled does not contain GMO or is organic. And it's like, so apart from the fact that everywhere the legislation requires you to test GMOs so much rigorously more than other varieties of plants that are for human consumption, that we're not even sure that they're actually all that safe. So you have to spend much more money for extra tests. Then if you have to spend even more money for labels that it does contain GMO, it really becomes very unattractive investment product for companies, and people just in some cases give up developing it or export it to places where it's not so badly regulated, like South America or the US. And then indeed, once I heard someone saying, I don't need my food to be labeled GMO because the one that is not GMO will be very obviously labeled, so why spend the money on extra labels?
Right, yeah. Well, so is this one of the topics you have a blog? Is this one of the topics that you cover on it? It's incubatorium.wordpress.com.
Yeah, well, I really want to write about GMOs, but I need to be in a very peace of mind so I can actually put really pure information on that blog post. So I have it in preparation, but I want to write it not emotionally as I am a little bit now, but purely scientifically. So people that get a bit confronted with the emotions of scientists that, oh yeah, of course they will support it, it's their baby, would actually read it and try to accept if it's purely scientific discussion that I'm offering. But I do write about other things that are very close to heart and completely at random. Sometimes I choose the topics for there.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's really cool. People can check that out at incubatorium.wordpress.com. And that's about all the time we have today. Thank you so much for coming on and explaining chaperones and giving us a little taste of GMOs and just, you know, hearing an outside view.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a great pleasure to talk to you.
Yeah, definitely. I love having guests on the show, and especially that in such a field that I don't know too much about. It's really exciting to learn new things on this show. So folks can go to dnapodcast.com, email in info@dnapodcast.com for any questions you have for me or our guest, and I can shoot them over to her and she can get back to you, because if you ask me anything about chaperones, I know she's going to know way more. So thanks for listening, and join me next week to learn and discover new advances in the world of genetics.
The genes of you and me, the genes of you and me, they're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA.